you will hear about and read research your entire career. Headlines report on positive treatment results and families come in asking about them. So how should we evaluate research and what makes a study good or flawed? In this episode, Mara and I will discuss the components of high quality research and the red flags associated with studies of lower quality. This episode will also help you to be better prepared to talk with families about research studies and results that can affect treatment decisions. Welcome to the Carlat Psychiatry Podcast. This is another special episode from the Child Psychiatry team. I'm Dr. Josh Fader, the editor-in-chief of the Carlat Child Psychiatry Report and co-author of the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice.
And I'm Mara Governman, a licensed clinical social worker in Southern California with a private practice. You know, there could be many different outcomes reported within a single study, and it can be difficult to discern which outcomes carry the most weight. So, Dr. Fader, which outcomes should we focus on the most in a particular study?
Randomized controlled trials, or RCTs, typically use several outcomes. Researchers declare a single outcome as the primary outcome before the study starts. This prevents them from cherry-picking a positive outcome after the data have been examined, then declaring it as the primary outcome. And it's important to note that a study is designed to specifically assess the primary outcome. This is a key point because the parameters included in a study's design, such as the sample size, duration of treatment, amount of follow-up evaluations, and many others, are chosen primarily to evaluate primary outcome measures.
Additionally, you should examine all secondary outcomes. Common secondary measures include patient self-reports, quality of life, levels of functioning in school, work, family life. Those measures provide valuable information and should be closely considered along with the clinician-rated symptom scales.
There may be different results across these outcomes. For instance, antidepressants have been shown to provide small benefits on depression rating scales for youth, but maybe yield no benefits on depression self-reports and quality of life measures compared to placebo.
It is easy to get excited about published positive treatment results, but further research may or may not support the initial findings. For industry studies, replication from a non-industry team is important. For therapy studies, replication of positive results by a separate research group is really important.
Two good RCTs of the same treatment for the same indication that both show positive results is much more powerful than any single trial. How often does this happen in child and adolescent psychopharmacology? Not often. Some treatments have demonstrated consistently poor results. For example, there are multiple studies showing no significant effect of desvenlafaxine or paroxetine on depression in youth.
Now, it's time to dive into the pros and cons of different study designs and the caveats associated with different designs and outcome variables. In open label studies, both researchers and patients know what the treatment is, and there is no control group. Positive results can be misleading because the patients may improve due to positive expectations or the natural course of their illness, rather than as a result of the treatment. Thus, open label studies may offer preliminary hope, but not solid evidence of efficacy.
I know, Mara. What you really hate to see is an open label trial that gets reported where people did worse. But we should have more of those published because that'll keep people from going in wrong directions. RCTs are a better way to evaluate a treatment's effects, but they must be examined closely. RCTs are supposed to be double blind, with participants and clinical raters unaware of who receives which intervention until the study's over. But drug side effects can unblind these studies and bias the results. Drugs with more obvious physical or psychological effects lead to greater unblinding. For instance, high-dose olanzapine is more likely to cause unblinding due to sedation, et cetera, than a low dose of, fluoxetine, for instance.
Also, the same clinical raters usually evaluate both efficacy and adverse events. A rater who notes drug-specific adverse events or a lack of adverse events may guess which patients are receiving the active treatment, defeating the purpose of the RCT. And researchers often declare that a treatment works if it has a statistically significant benefit over placebo. But what exactly does statistical significance mean?
Hold on to your hats, right? Right. In an RCT, suppose an antidepressant outperforms placebo by 2 points on a depression rating scale. Based on scores obtained on the rating scale, statistical calculations generate what we call a p-value. The p-value is the likelihood, the probability that the result that you got, medication outperforming placebo by 2 points, could be explained by a null hypothesis that claims that there's no treatment effect. Do you remember the null hypothesis from high school?
Yep.
That's like the assumption that whatever you're doing doesn't work. And then you try to disprove that. And if you disprove that, then maybe it works.
So in other words, if the drug really had no effect, i.e., the null hypothesis is true, what are the odds that the study would find at least a 2-point benefit for the drug? If the p-value is less than 0.05, 5%, the result is deemed statistically significant.
Right. Like, it means that there's a 1 in 20 chance that the sample that you got is wrong and there really is no difference, but 19 out of 20 chances that there really is a difference between the two groups. It doesn't necessarily mean that the result is important, however. Among other things, the size of the sample is influential. A very small treatment benefit may be statistically significant in a large study and be clinically meaningless.
Statistical significance gives some confidence that there is a treatment effect. It is an important first step, but it's not the final word on treatment efficacy.
What we really want to know is the effect size, the magnitude of the treatment effect. Common convention is that 0.2 is a small effect size, 0.5 is medium, and 0.8 or more is large. In psychiatry, effect sizes are often nearly always small to medium effects compared to placebo.
It is now standard practice to report effect size in treatment studies. A study that fails to report effect size may be hiding a minimal treatment benefit, so pay attention to that. Clinicians often prefer categorical outcomes like response and remission. Is there anything we should look out for when studies report categorical outcomes?
Well, categorical outcomes sound great, but they aren't always impressive. Categories have arbitrary cutoff points. For instance, in autism, we can look at total ADOS scores and think about changes from a severe to moderate range, moderate to mild, et cetera. But this can be a little tricky. If a patient score goes from the low end of severe to the high end of moderate, that's not necessarily clinically all that meaningful. So pay attention to total scores along with any categorical outcomes. One exception would be if you go across two categories. So we have that one Solomon study in autism on ADOS with his play project developmental model, where he had a bunch of people who went down one category on ADOS, but a bunch who went down two categories. And that actually is a pretty impressive result.
And it's especially important to check the number needed to treat, or the NNT, and the number needed to harm, also known as the NNH, for categorical outcomes.
Yeah, the NNT, NNH stuff refers to the number of people who would need to receive the treatment in order to gain an additional positive or negative outcome over what would have occurred if everybody got placebo.
The lower of NNT, the better. An NNT of 5 is often considered impressive, and NNTs of more than 10 are often considered unimpressive. But there is no firm consensus on this.
On the other hand, for the number needed to harm, or NNH, the acceptable range might vary from 10 to 100. Depending on the severity of the side effect. For a severe side effect, such as Stevens-Johnson syndrome, you want to see a much higher number before you expect somebody to be hurt.
Most RCTs last only a few weeks, while child development is measured in years. One cannot assume long-lasting benefit based on a positive short-term RCT. Most studies of long-term drug efficacy inappropriately use a randomized discontinuation design.
These studies start with only participants who have responded to the drug in the short term. By random assignment, some participants are usually abruptly switched to placebo while others continue to take the drug. This conflates A, drug withdrawal effects among those switched to placebo with B, treatment efficacy in those who keep taking the drug. The worse the drug discontinuation effects, the worse the placebo group performs after being taken off medication, and the better those who stay on the medication seem in comparison.
A better test of long-term effects then is to simply lengthen a short-term placebo-controlled RCT. But this is expensive and might reduce the hoped-for positive findings of the researchers, so it is rarely done. Speaking of things that might shine a negative light on a particular drug in a study, let's talk about side effects. Is there anything we should keep an eye out for when it comes to the reporting of adverse events in a study?
Oh, definitely, Mara. Ideally, randomized controlled trials, RCTs, should accurately detect adverse events, while weight and some lab measures are usually reliably assessed in RCTs. Most adverse events are assessed vaguely. For example, until recently, there was little attempt to ask specific questions regarding suicidality in most treatment studies, leading to an underreporting of such events.
Adverse events must be systematically assessed. Otherwise, studies may be unable to detect them. Also, researchers often don't report all recorded adverse events in journal studies.
Yeah, not only is this highly unethical, but it can have seriously dangerous implications for clinical practice. The prevalence of underreporting serious adverse events is systemic, and it was highlighted in a 2014 cross-sectional study of 244 summaries associated with published research articles. These summaries were from trials that evaluated the efficacy of 6 antidepressant and antipsychotic drugs. Out of the 1,608 drug-related serious adverse events presented in the trial summaries, about 43% of them didn't make it into their associated articles. This is shocking. According to this study, the majority of deaths and suicides, about 62% and 53% of cases respectively, were not reported in the published articles. So it's critical that you keep an eye out for how adverse events are recorded and reported. And by the way, it's important that when you have an adverse event, God forbid something worse than a rash, you should report it. There's a federal system for doing that.
News journals and morning talk shows love covering stories on how a new study found the treatment that cures disease X. And it's easy to get all excited about these treatments, which is why it's pretty common for patients and families to ask us about certain treatments or interventions that they heard on the news. We want our patients to be actively involved in our treatment plans, but we also need to formulate and discuss treatment plans that are supported by high-quality research. So how can we help families understand that much of the popular press coverage of research is misleading without sounding cynical or disrespectful?
We need to listen respectfully, then describe in a calm and neutral manner the hope that an open-label study provides, and that controlled trials are going to be needed to know whether the treatment is truly helpful.
For example, in the recent CCPR Jan, February, and March 2021 issue, we talked with Dr. Aaron Besterman about how results from pharmacogenetic testing, while interesting, are unlikely in most cases to lead to changes in good treatment.
To recap, Mara and I will provide you with a quick and easy clinical research checklist that you should use when evaluating a study. Here we go. Is the study an RCT or an open label trial?
If it's an open label design, then the natural course of illness, placebo effect, and researcher biases may have caused improvement, rather than the treatment itself.
But if it's an RCT, is everyone blinded to which treatment the patient received? Note that drug side effects might unblind the treatment.
For each efficacy outcome, are the results statistically significant? And what is the treatment effect size? Again, small effect size is 0.2, a medium effect size is 0.5, and a large effect size is 0.8. Did the study include secondary outcomes like parent reports, self-reports, improvements in daily functioning, or changes in quality of life?
Remember that categorical outcomes, for example, remission or response, are usually based on arbitrary cutoff scores. Also consider categorical outcomes in the context of rating scales and other outcomes. What is the number needed to treat NNT for these outcomes? And if an adverse event is not systematically measured, it is likely to be underreported.
When assessing whether a drug is effective over the long term, you should know that randomly assigning some patients from drug to placebo may cause drug discontinuation effects and invalidate the comparison.
As a bottom line message, it's imperative that you pay attention to the quality of the study and the effect sizes of particular treatments. Educate families about how you use your professional judgment to give them truly evidence-based recommendations. The clinical update will be available for subscribers to read in the CARLAT Child Psychiatry Report. Hopefully, people will check it out. Subscribers get print issues in the mail and email notifications when new issues are available on the website. Subscriptions also come with full access to all the articles on the website and CME credit.
And everything from CARLAT Publishing is independently researched and produced. There's no funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, the newsletters and books we produce depend entirely on reader support. There are no ads, and our authors do not receive industry funding for this work. That helps us to bring you unbiased information that you can trust.
As always, thanks for listening and have a great day.